The conference committee for House File 2553 will come to order. We're going to start this morning with testimony from White House, I believe, in particular because some Senate members have questions about what White House's plans are. And so we're going to start by calling Tony Perkins, the executive director of the Salisbury United Community, who is Wagner, not Perkins, Wagner. Tony Wagner, who is the executive director of Salisbury United Communities, which is the organization serving as the umbrella for White House. So, Mr. Wagner, please state your name for the record and proceed with some testimony.
My name is Tony Wagner. I'm president of Salisbury United Communities. Good morning. Would you like me to
proceed, please?
Oh, all right. Well, I think you are. First of all, I just want to say up front here, thank you all for even considering this. We are, as you know, an organization that went through some trauma as a result of the bridge disaster. We've been trying to do the best we can supporting the children and our own staff who are part of that issue. We've asked, and I think you have before you, a three-year request of the state to help us continue our work with those children and families in several different ways. And the total is for the 3 years is $610,000. I understand there's a typo in the original document that we sent you. We're looking at trying to do some things that we are not currently equipped to do, mainly around the support, both therapeutic services, the support for the families, and the parents. I think most of you are aware that these families and the children that we have worked with are families who are living on the edge to begin with in our society, and so they've experienced a very difficult situation. We hope that in the next 3 years, doing things a little differently and focusing more clearly on these families will allow them to get on their feet, stay on their feet, and hopefully, as we all believe, have this opportunity to become productive members of our community. So, I don't know how detailed you want me to go into, Representative Winkler, in terms of the budget, but...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bethel.
Mr. Chair, I was the one who would requested further information, and, you know, we're aware of the children and what happened on the bus and like that. We don't need to really get into details of that, but, you know, there's a proposal in both bills for $680,000, and if this is the document that I'm supposed to be looking at, I want to get a clear understanding of how those dollars are to be allocated. I mean, I read through some of the proposals, for instance, for summer youth camps and so forth, and it isn't quite clear to me how the funds, you know, are to be allocated, how they are going to benefit dealing with the particular incident we have here. And I think we need more information. This is a nice start, but it doesn't tell me. I need a better idea of the breakdown of how you justify the whole sum and this is actually going to accomplish its purpose.
There are Wagner. Sir Bethel, there are five areas that we're asking for support in. First of all, family advocacy. To help us hire an additional two staff to work specifically with these 52 children and families. And the kind of work that they will be doing in that particular program will be getting to know the individual situation with each of the families, working with them to develop a plan for how they're going to get their needs met during this period, and working with the various institutions to make sure that they are responsive to the families. That's a bigger job than usual, given who these families are and the limited language skills for many of them, that sort of thing. So that's one major piece of this.
Oh, and then, Mr. Chair,
and
one question I've got, of course, is the fact that you're proposing this over a three-year period of time, and I don't know that there's any guarantee that all these children are going to stay with you over a three-year period of time. So would there be some sort of a plan to transfer some of these funds to follow the students, you know, if they happen to go to some other program? Because if you have a diminishing number of students here, and I don't know what kind of turnover you've got, but we want to make sure the dollars actually go to the students, not to Waite House.
I agree, and this plan is about focusing on the children and following them, and that is, you know, that is a different way to for many of us to operate in the work that we do. So our intention is that this will be focused. All these dollars, these family advocates, will stay with the children and their families, even if they move to other locations, with the exception that we probably can't help them if they move out of state. But I want to assure you that this budget is based on the fact that it will follow the children and their families.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Bessel,
then you're saying that these family advocates will be working with these children and only these children and their families and nobody else.
That's correct.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess I have some of the same questions Senator Bessel has raised. I'm just wondering why we wouldn't be better off just funding the families directly. There are other families and other children presumably involved in this tragedy that are not participants in your program, and they're going to be doing whatever they do to deal with the issues that they have, and they're going to be doing it out of some resources that are made available either through their own insurance or through whatever funding that we provide to the state. And I just wonder why we wouldn't want to do that directly rather than funding this program, or if there's an argument to fund other programs that other bridge victims are participating in. Why would we want to? I'm just not clear why that is the right approach rather than just directly funding the victims.
Mr. Wagner.
I think you have to sort of understand the kind of relationship that our staff has with these families, the kind of trust that's been built up with them, the fact that many of these children and families have the difficulty as it is participating in the programs and opportunities in our community. So, I can't sit here and say that wouldn't work. Our sense is that it would not work based upon our experience. Giving the money directly to the families, that they rely on us now for all sorts of assistance and advocacy services. So, from our opinion, this is the better approach than to give it directly to them.
Mr. Chairman, so your testimony is that there is no other organization that can help these children or these families other than yours, and that they wouldn't take advantage of any other help other than what was provided to your organization. Is that correct?
My testimony, sir, is that given the relationships that we already have with these families, that yes, we are the best organization to provide these services.
Representative Tom.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I think your comments kind of reflect a lack of understanding of the situation at Waite House and with these children. And I would suggest a person to talk to who, you know, as opposed to talking to some of the inner city legislators who are really familiar with how places like Tillsbury House and Waite House work, that you talk to Senator Olsen, who spent considerable amounts of time at Waite House and doing it. And he had to learn this from the beginning. And I think if you talk to him, you'll understand what we're saying. And if you listened very carefully to the witness, he didn't say they were the only place. He said they were certainly the best place. And if you certainly understand the multiple difficulties that these families have, you'll understand that it's totally not comparable to any of the things that other victims of more ordinary middle-class Minnesotans might have.
There, last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wagner, welcome. when the White House made their original proposal before the Claims Committee, it appeared to be a matching grant proposal so it was basically a $1.3 million social services proposal, of which they were seeking funding for half from the state. Now, your first comment was that there was a typo. I want to make sure I understand what the grant, what your request is. $680,000 in the bill at White House's request. What's the figure now that you're seeking from the state?
The mistake is that the total figure should reach $610,000 from the state. And I think what happened here, unfortunately, we just discovered this morning, but I think what happened here is the Minneapolis Foundation Fund that was set up did give us an initial grant right after the event to provide grief counseling and immediate services to the kids. And that $70,000 was spent in 2007, which does not appear in here, and I think that should not have been part of the total. Do they have this document?
They do.
What we know is that the numbers contributing to the totals are the correct numbers, and if you add them up, they add up to 610,000, not 680.
Senator Lynch, Chairman Mr. Wagner, thank you for that clarification. Now, is this still a joint proposal, a matching proposal? So it's a $1.2 million 3-year social services program you're seeking to implement?
Mr. Wagner?
I don't know that I would describe it as a matching proposal. We are asking for similar amounts from the Minneapolis Foundation Fund. But it should be noted that a significant amount of the Minneapolis Foundation Fund will not be given to us. It will be held in reserve for the families as they come forward with various needs. But it's sort of part of the overall package.
Just to clarify, the numbers that we have on this table do total $680,000. So where is the error here on this table that it should come out to $610,000?
Senator Betzold, I think there's an arithmetic disagreement on the Conference Committee, and Ms. Roberts will retotal them for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think that there is just an error in the total 680. When I added up all ways across the table, the total for the state of Minnesota is 610.
Okay.
If you add 235 plus 215 plus 160, those are the 3 years, that totals to 610, and I've added it up internally also.
Okay, so it's just the bottom right-hand corner. Which is 60, that's the only error. Okay, thanks.
Yes. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wagner, I guess one of the questions that I've wondered about as this has gone forward is that the insurance that the White House has as a program, has any of that insurance been available to the victims of the families of the students for medical purposes or other kinds of... In other words, I know we've heard from the bus company that part of the insurance that was covering the bus has been used to provide compensation and help for medical expenses and other things, but I'm assuming that your program is insured, and are there proceeds from your insurance also being directed to the families of the students in your program?
Mr. Wagner.
Senator, we are insured. We are insured for general liability insurance. To my knowledge, none of that insurance has been available, and nor is it, I understand, available for these students.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wrighton, why would that be? If you have liability insurance for people in your program and they're injured as a part of something in your program, why wouldn't their compensation be available to them as victims?
And Mr. Wagner,
First of all, let me say I'm not an insurance expert, so I'm on shaky ground here. But my understanding is that there are levels of who goes first in insurance, And for example, with the bus company, it's my understanding that if a family had personal automobile insurance, that would be the first insurance applied to this case, then the bus company. And I don't know what happens if the bus company insurance runs out. There is a cap on that. I don't know. All I know is from our insurance agent that we've contacted is that they are taking the position that they're not liable.
Yes.
In this situation. Well, now, that hasn't been pushed to court or anything like that, but that's where it's at.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm a little surprised. I would think that your program as an insured entity would have some liability to provide some compensation, and I'm just frankly a little bit concerned that we're advancing a claim against the state when your own interest, your own entity, is not providing any compensation to victims at all. So I'm just surprised at that. I guess maybe there's some clarification on what that can mean. But I was surprised. I guess I was thinking that your insurance would also be kicking in to provide some help for the victims of the families of the students in your program.
Representative Simon, did you?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I'm looking at the summary sheet here, the two-page summary sheet, and under therapeutic support on the back page, it talks about determining the level and kind of help needed in either simpler or more complex trauma recovery, post-traumatic stress disorder assessments, etc. Am I correct in reading that to say that those analyses have not yet been done?
That's my situation.
Okay. And that sort of surprises me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That surprises me, too. Just many months afterwards, I would have thought that maybe someone, I don't lay that at the feet of White House necessarily, but I'm just saying it's surprising to me that just many months into it, that those analyses haven't been done, that we don't know yet which of the children need more or less the kind of services that you provide. I only say that because presumably we don't want a one-size-fits-all approach, particularly as to the state money, and it may be that some of the children need more in the way of these services, and maybe some need far less. Maybe it's safer to assume a one-size-fits-all, but do you have any comment on that?
Well, soon after the disaster, we obviously were very concerned about what happened to these children. So we, as part of that Minneapolis Foundation request, and in fact, before that request came in, we scrambled to find competent grief counselors and trauma counselors, and we found those, and they were available the day after the disaster. They worked with the families for a very short time, and it was about trying to get them over the initial trauma. What my understanding is that in these kinds of situations, if it's post-traumatic stress, and again, I'm not an expert in this area, so please understand that, but that sometimes the symptoms don't occur for months, maybe years afterward. So what we are experiencing at White House now, after that initial work with the children, now we're starting to begin to see additional problems come forward. So we've worked with professionals in the therapeutic community about this, trying to prepare ourselves and the families for what may happen. But to my understanding, no one has done a thorough review of each of these cases, and it may be that it will take a while.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Understanding, as you say, that it will take a while. With that disclaimer out of the way, can you tell us, based on your own interaction with some or all of the 52 children, what is your sort of sense of how most of them are doing? Understanding that you're not an expert in this area, understanding all those disclaimers. Generally speaking, are these kids doing okay? Are they doing not so okay?
Representative Simon, we do have other representatives from White House here who have had more direct day-to-day contact, and if you'd like, we can ask them to come down and offer some comments in that regard.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think that would be appropriate, because I've never visited White House, and I'd like to know a little bit more about how the kids are doing right now, since we're on the verge of we're talking about a good chunk of money.
We have Rachel Henderson. If she could come down, please, and just give us a sense of how the children are reacting. You never know what happens when you come to the legislature. If you could please state your name for the record.
I'm Rachel Henderson. I'm the family advocate at White House. I was hired to work with the children and their families after the bus incident. To get directly to answering your question, after they're struggling, like Tony suggested, there are a lot of symptoms and a lot of issues that are only starting to come up now. Students who seemed like they were doing okay immediately after the incident have started having more problems in school. As some of you probably know, progress reports just came out, and we've seen a lot of things that we had no idea that kids were having problems with, that we didn't know that, but they seemed like they were doing okay. So I think that we're in at a point right now where we're realizing that there's more issues that we need to address and help the kids find adequate and appropriate counseling.
Representative Stein.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to belabor the point. I'm just trying to get a sense beyond the just sort of cold page of writing here. If you, if you could just tell us, for those of us who haven't had the privilege of visiting, when you say that these kids are facing problems, could you just flesh it out a little bit? What does that mean day to day? If there is a such thing as a typical example, and maybe there isn't, what does that mean? Is it a kid who says he or she can't get beyond certain things, or how does that work?
Ms. Henderson.
I think that one point that has been brought up before, I believe, but can't be emphasized enough, is that a lot of our students are facing multiple large barriers to academic success, to financial success, to moving, to becoming productive members of society, and White House had a lot of students who were on really good tracks. We've been able to provide them with a lot of academic support, with a lot of moral support, with a structured environment. So we've had a lot of students who are doing up until this year, doing really well in school, who were leaders in their schools, who were leaders in their community. And a lot of those students are the ones who we're seeing now having complaining of a lot of trouble concentrating in school, of a lack of interest in school, of a lack of interest in the activities that they used to really be interested in, that they used to love. We also have students on a different track complaining about a lot of trouble sleeping, trouble with nightmares, or just unable to rest at night. Things of that nature are the most common, I think, cases of what we're seeing at White House.
Representative Cox.
Again, if legislators would like some personal information from other legislators, Kane Clark apparently lives very close to a family that had two children on the bus, and her story was that the day after it happened, she went and talked to the mother, and the mother said, oh, everything's fine, the kids are doing fine, there's no problem. And within a couple of weeks then, there were the kids, they don't want to go to school, they're depressed, they're not. All of these great measures of success that were attended on these kids are no longer there, and she's quite distraught about the change of what had happened.
Representative DeLaForest.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question going back to the $610,000 proposal, so I'd defer to colleagues if they had other questions for this witness.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. Be prepared. You may be called back. Representative DeLaForce.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And a question for the witness. Sir, your testimony from a few moments ago confused me, and I want to better understand the nature of the Minneapolis Foundation's offer to match the appropriation. If the state of Minnesota makes this targeted appropriation, what is the nature of the Minneapolis Foundation's commitment to match that? Is it a binding type of commitment that's a dollar for dollar, or is it more aspirational that you're hoping to leverage some dollars?
Mr. Wagon.
Representative, I think it's in the latter category. It's not a commitment. There's nothing in writing. The Minneapolis Foundation became the repository of all sorts of goodwill that people had, and they have established their own procedures and ideas about how that money should be distributed. To this point, we've gotten some of the money for which we're grateful. We're hoping that they will continue to support us in the manner in which we've laid out here, but there is no guarantee.
And Mr. Wagner, Representative DeLaForest, I took from your testimony that the Minneapolis Foundation may be helping individual families as where part of that money is going to be coming from, as opposed to putting money into programming for the organization. Is that what your testimony was before?
It was. A significant amount of the money that we're looking for from the Minneapolis Foundation will be in terms of family support, so the families will contact them directly. But it is also true that we're asking them for additional support.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just in reading on page 2 of the document here, I just read in the first sentence under the proposal section, the word leveraged, and of course to us that's a term of art meaning sort of an if-then relationship. If a dollar is appropriated from the legislature, then some amount will be matched either in whole or in part by another organization. But thank you for the clarification.
If I may, Representative, when I say it's not guaranteed, that doesn't mean we haven't had several positive conversations with them. We have, but it's not as if there's a contract.
Representative
Tom. Mr. Chairman, it might be appropriate if before we finish this conference committee, we had a conversation with the Minneapolis Foundation about whether it would help them to have formal leverage language in or what their intentions are.
Representative Tom. Senator
Moore. Mr. Chair, I feel like I've been kind of tuned out a little bit on the White House proposal, and I'm wondering if somebody could clarify for me what is contemplated. Are we thinking that if the White House proposal was funded on its own, that the children, I believe it's 52 plus 2, that were on the bus, would then be separated from the other victims and therefore would become ineligible for application for funding under the other categories of wherever we come up? Or is this a separate appropriation? And then if any of the children have suffered an ongoing medical condition that surfaces over time, that they would also be able to make a claim or would be eligible for the other appropriations?
Senator Moore, the House bill, and I think the Senate bill was amended with language that was similar, and then it was amended again on the floor by Senator Berglund, but so I guess the House bill is in both. The intention is that this would not preclude them from potentially being part of the pool of people who are making applications for the special master for funds. But this is more of a targeted case management community response kind of grant. That's the intention of the White House component, just to deal with the challenges that the families in this particular community have in responding to this traumatic event. Which is different from, I think, a lot of the resources or backup, maybe, that a lot of the other folks who run the bridge have had. And I think it's important to understand that this has been a community response in the Phillips neighborhood, centers around White House. This is not like an organization that decided it was in charge. This is just a community institution that was there. They've responded from the beginning. They've been tasked in trying to do so, and this is to continue their efforts, and it's not intended to preclude these kids from potentially being among the group of survivors getting compensation. But it's also important to understand that most of the kids have not had debilitating physical injuries. They've had chiropractor visits and so on, but they're not the kind of major medical events that some of the other survivors have faced.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I am a little bit confused because in conversations and as we've been having this conversation, a lot of the conversation has been focused that this is for the kids, this is for the children, this is going to be the children focused. And so now, though, as I'm hearing your explanation, which is that, well, this is now for White House or the specific community response or for the family, and I just want to, for my own thinking, I am concerned about the children, and I am concerned about how young they are, and I am concerned about what is yet unknown. And I wouldn't want this, if this comes about or not, I wouldn't want this in some way, I guess, to be misconstrued to be prejudicial if they do have medical, ongoing medical things that do surface. I just didn't want this conversation to be prejudicial to the opportunity for them.
And Senator Moore, I didn't want to, I hope I didn't confuse you. This is focused on the children, but it's talking about assets in the community that are best suited to help those children and those families respond and recover. Senator Bessel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did go through family advocacy, and I think we talked about some other issues here, too, but I do, there's some other categories here which I don't quite understand, and if I may, I'd like to just clarify some of these things, too. Like, it says Family Support Fund, and at the top of page 3, it's estimated $120,000 will be dispersed to help pay for rent, medical bills, food, household supplies, enrollment applications, medical bills. So medical bills listed twice. I'm just curious, though. I mean, rent, household supplies, how is it, you know, it's my understanding that virtually all the families that go to White House services have, you know, have challenges. And so how do we decide, or who's going to decide who needs their rent paid or food? How much to pay? I mean, how are decisions to be made? How to allocate that? And as I say, medical bills listed twice. So,
Mr. Wagner,
Senator Bessel, our intention is, and the way we will work with this group of children and families, is to create a case plan, as Representative Winkler suggested. And within that, we'll be an assessment of where the family is, what the needs are, what the children's needs are. Whatever those services are that in our judgment will be the best services to get this family moving forward to stay on its feet is how that will be developed. So we put in all of these as possibilities, but it'll depend on the individual assessment that's made with these families.
Sure. Representative Silver.
Chair, point of clarification on that. The anticipated funds for the Family Support Fund is not from the state. Is that correct?
That's
Mr.
correct.
Mr. Wagner.
And
Representative
Silver. The list that Senator Bessel read off is the type of support that the state would give to a family in other programs. And so is this, are those families not getting that type of support from other programs, state-run programs, social service programs, or do they need additional support because of this?
Representative, I think the distinction here is that, yes, they will have access to that kind of support from the Minneapolis Foundation Fund for this, but what we're asking the state to fund is a person who will work with these families to develop those case plans and monitor them and make sure that progress is being made on those case plans.
Well,
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, that's not part of the Family Support Fund, though, is it? Is that part of the Family Advocacy Fund?
No, that's from the Parent Support Component that Senator Bessel was referring to.
Oh, the bottom part.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Senator Bessel.
Mr. Chair, if you could talk about the youth enrichment programming, what were the ages of the children who were on the bus? The range.
I'm going to have to defer to come back to present your statistics.
Senator Bessel, the ages are from 5 to 16.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Wagner, for instance, you're talking about employment and career counseling. You know, maybe the 16-year-olds might qualify for that. I don't know how many there were, but I don't think we need to have employment and career counseling for a 5-year-old. I don't know what the purposes of these summer day camps would be and how this ties in. There could very well be some issues here, but sports and fitness, how could you give us a further explanation as to how the $75,000 annually is going to tie into addressing the needs of the students directly related to bridge class.
Ms. Henderson or Mr. Wagner?
Do you want to go first?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm actually the best to answer that question as far as budgeting goes. Those are components to our youth program that have been highly valued by our participants and are identified as the most important to keeping kids are all of our students on a track toward both academic success, personal success, toward building self-confidence and toward recovery and becoming active members in their community once again.
Mr. Wagner.
Senator, these were also, they described the kind of youth program we do. We didn't mean to say that every student on the bus would get every component here. So if it's career counseling, obviously that doesn't make sense for a five-year-old. Does make sense for a 16-year-old. But the description here is gives you a picture of the overall kind of activity that occurs in our youth program, which would benefit these kids.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wagner, I don't quite understand. Is this something you're already doing? And if so, why do you need funds from the state and the Minneapolis Foundation to do that if it's something you're already doing?
Mr. Wagner.
I think because these kids need special focus. We are not able to do the intensive work with our normal program for kids. And these kids are coming to us with needs beyond what our staff is capable of handling at the moment. So it's more of an intensity issue than it is sort of what is the program and are we doing it?
Senator Betzel, if I may, I think it's also important to note here that eight of our staff were also on the bus. There were eight youth program staff, some of whom haven't come back to work, some of whom are back part-time, almost none are back in the full capacity that they were before.
Senator Hand. Oh, sorry, Senator Betzel,
well,
have a follow-up?
And I don't recall whether the appropriation is for the staff or it's for the youth and youth families. It doesn't refer to the staff in the appropriation that we have in the bill. So if there are staff that needs it, you know, maybe that should have been addressed as well, too. Mr. Chair, as I served as Simon talking about therapeutic support, I do have questions about the parent support component. And you're seeking a staff position and team with the two family advocates to provide services to parents and the school bus children provide greater resiliency. There's a number of things listed in here that I would assume can or should already be done, but I mean when we get down to text, tobacco cessation services, how does that relate to children who are on the school bus?
Mr. Wagner.
So that's a lot. I understood your comment to be about the parent support.
The parent support, right. That's you list a number of things to be done here, including tobacco cessation services for parent support, a number of services which probably should already be provided and helping parents, you know, achieve self-sufficiency. But I just don't know whether you're doing some of these things already and why would tobacco cessation services be a significant issue in this area?
Mr. Wagner.
Some of these things we are doing currently, Senator. But again, I would say that the focus of this particular proposal relates to the intensity of the need that these families and children are experiencing. This parent support component is about helping the parents of these children to keep their situations as stable as possible so that the children can actually thrive or do better. So it's not like we have a lot of people running around with things to do at Wade House. The difficulty is that this situation with these families has produced an extraordinarily, I think, strong need, and we're confronted with how do we meet that need, and do we meet that need? So, bottom line is we're asking for your help to hire staff to work with those children and those families to get them through this period. And I think the proposal we're describing there are some of the things that we currently do to give you an idea of what the nature of the service is when we work with these families. So in a general sense, we are doing these things, but we cannot do them as intensely as, I mean, we're not, the need is much more intense, I should say.
Senator Betzel, I guess one comment I would make is there were a number of questions that perhaps not quite as involved, but as we went through the House process, and one of the amendments that we adopted was to stage the payments for this grant out over three, or to, say, to create three stages of payment, one immediately, one in August, and one in August of 2009, and require reports back to the legislature on those expenditures. In addition, the Senate added an amendment requiring the Commissioner of Finance to approve the budget for this expenditure prior to the funds going out. So there is a recognition of the need for some oversight and basic accountability when we're putting this money out contained in the bill. And I don't think that any of us would be averse to having any further suggestions about how we can make sure that the money is being spent in the most effective way.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I wasn't there at every step of the Senate process, Senator Latz was, but the only time that I was aware of the White House issue coming up was in the Senate Finance Committee, which was right actually the last stop before the bill went to the floor. And actually we were pressed because the floor session had already started, and we were pressed for time. And I think we were a bit concerned that we did not have a full idea of what it is that the $680,000, which is in both bills, was for. And that's, I think, why Senator Berglund, you know, had the floor amendment to indicate that she wanted a, some more accountability. But I think there was some uneasiness within the Senate Finance Committee as this appropriation, and you know, the more I'm looking at it, I still have a number of questions here, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bessel will be happy to entertain as many questions as you like, and they are good questions.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to hear from other members too, but as I say, these I don't know that, you know, the situation being what it was, I don't know that we want to get into a situation where we're funding things that White House already does, or that we're funding things that may not be directly related to, directly or at least have some nexus to the injuries, the trauma that was suffered by the children. And some of these things, I just don't see the connection.
I mean, anybody can make the connection, saying they were traumatized, these children are from families with special needs, but, you know, we could make this list a couple of dozen pages long and say it's all connected, and that doesn't necessarily make it so.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Chairman, and I just want to go back to testimony a few minutes ago that there was eight staff on the bus, and I guess is there a part of this funding that would go to help those staff that were also affected by this? And I guess second to that is the White House program insurance compensating any of the staff for their injuries or their need for counseling or their other things that they may be experiencing? Is White House insurance paying their costs?
Mr. Wagner.
Several of the, yes, the answer is yes. Several of the staff receive workers' compensation for their absences and injuries. So I don't know exactly how many, but I know that staff has been compensated for the injuries and the loss of work and that sort of thing that resulted.
And, Mr. Chairman, and just to clarify, is the $610,000 also going to be used then for the benefit of staff help, or is this just for the kids?
It is just for the kids and their families.
Okay.
If I may, Mr. Wagner, sorry, Representative, I think that partly what happened here is not only were the eight staff, they were almost all of our youth program staff. And so as we, the busiest time for our organization is in the fall when school begins, and it really set us back significantly, not only dealing with all of the results of trauma, but also trying to meet the needs of the other kids in the neighborhood. So it was a pretty intense time, and I think our staff responded admirably to this event. But it's been difficult for our staff to get back in shape and ready to go again.
Senator Hanna, it's also, I think, relevant that it's not necessarily a clear distinction, but many of the children who participate in the youth program as they come through become part of the youth staff, and so they may have had siblings who were also on the bus, and part of families that were, in fact, I believe that was the case. There were families that had, you know, older, you know, young adults or older adolescents who were part of the staff and had younger children who were part of the program. So there is not always a, you know, this is truly kind of a program where kids matriculate up through, and it's part of the leadership track. And so in many ways, the health of the youth program is a indicator of the health of the children and their families as they're moving through this. Senator Kahn.
You know, again, if you talk to Jamie, now what was her position, the field worker?
Julie.
Yeah, when you talk to her, one of the things that comes forward much so clearly is how many of these kids, one of the reasons they were on this bus trip was because they were being rewarded for being in this leadership track program. When you talk to her, the deterioration of these kids who had already stepped forward to be leaders in the community and the problems that they showed afterwards, you know, was kind of more defined because these were kids who were already on a track to success, and the backwards thing was so totally obvious.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I have no doubt in my mind that White House as an entity is doing a phenomenal job of providing services and opportunities to the children and families in that neighborhood. And I think that to the extent that we can help them, because obviously this situation has put tremendous stress on them as an organization from a staffing perspective, but also from a programming perspective, because you know they're not going to say no to the needs that are coming out, because as a community, I mean, they want to be responsive. So as an organization, as an entity, I have no doubt that they're experiencing tremendous distress. And that, in the larger context, that there has been tremendous disinvestment over time for organizations like White House, as we have been looking at the programmatic cuts that have been made, the reductions in reimbursements. So, you know, this is... This situation, I understand very clearly, is just a convergence of yet another stress factor on an organization that is probably already running on a very, very tight budget strain. And to the extent that we can find some way to be helpful with that, I want to do that. That's, I think, a separate conversation, because clearly what I'm hearing is that the organization wants to do the right thing, cares deeply about the children, has staff people who want to do this. They want to continue to meet the needs of the children and the family in as creative a way as possible, and we ought to try to find a way to help them do that. Then the children and the family themselves, of course, are experiencing tremendous distress. It's not as if people who are already under so much distress could, you know, add on yet another layer. And so I think that there's that component of it. So I think one of the things for me is that, yet is this necessarily the best way for us to, recognizing those factors, is this necessarily the best way for us to help the two groups of people? White House is an entity, and then the families and the children who are affected by it. I don't know. I mean, maybe at the end of the day, after we've, you know, have the full discussion, this may be the only way, and I'm not opposed to that. On the other hand, I think that we shouldn't be so tunneled and so focused in the proposal that we're kind of boxing ourselves in and not being thoughtful about what other potential opportunities are out there. I mean, what does White House do at the end of 3 years? It's not as if these children and their families are, you know, some may move on to doing other things. But, I mean, what happens at the end of 3 years? Do we then suddenly, once they lose the leverage from the state, then what happens to them and their ability to leverage support from other entities and other organizations? You know, are we better off finding some potential resource for them that's a little, the organization that's a little bit more sustaining, and putting some of this funding that's supposed to go towards the family and the children into a fund or trust that the children maybe can continue to use for ongoing mental health care if that's what they need? I don't know. But I think that it's, as we're looking at this, I'm interested in seeing to what extent we can make a commitment to White House as an entity, recognizing how devastating, you know, having to respond to this has been on them as an organization, and then separating out how we're going to help provide services to the children and their families if they're affected by this in a way that's responsible and responsive.
Well, I'll just, Senator Moore, one thing I'll just comment on is that this kind of three-year time frame, three-year plan was developed in consultation with children's mental health and children's trauma experts who have been working on a pro bono basis with White House and trying to develop this plan. So it is based on at least some expertise in understanding kind of those horizon of trauma or impact that this kind of thing can have on children and on these families. Will the effects be ongoing? Probably, but hopefully as part of the case management approach that they have, they can identify what some of the longer-term needs are and identify what public or other kinds of resources may be available to help them. Or it may be that if they have an ongoing need, that if through the compensation fund, they can get some amount of money, and it can be part of a trust or an annuity or some other kind of a suitable vehicle. And in fact, I don't know how many, but a good number of the children are also represented by one or the other of the major legal representation efforts going on here, too. So at least I think you'll have some people who are looking out for the best way to plan for the use of those funds as well. Now, there may be better and more thoughtful things to do, and I know that others have thought, well, shouldn't the county step forward and do this? Isn't this the county's role? And it may well be, but this is the organization that was on the ground and has been doing it. So we thought it was at least the first thought was, well, let's enable them to keep doing it and do so more successfully. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I think the most telling answer to your question is in the period that this whole proposal has been out, maybe even since October 1st, no one has come up with an alternative that looks as if it would have any better chance of success or is any more directed or is any more knowledgeable than the two ones that are in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, in response to your comment about legal representation, three months ago, at the Claims Committee meeting at which White House presented its proposal, we were told that 20 of the kids on the bus had been connected by staff at White House to lawyers and had already secured legal representation. There may be more now. We don't know. But at least 20 of them, maybe more than half at this point, will be participating in the other claims process to seek compensation for their losses, compensation which would at least cover some of what is being proposed to be covered in this proposal. How much, we don't know. One of the amendments that was generated from questions at the Senate Finance Committee was to provide that any money here would be offset by whatever funds would go through the claims process to individual claimants for services that would ordinarily be compensable in those services, in that claims compensation process, the tort. So if it's medical bills, if it's therapy, which anything which arises out of a physical injury, which would include mental anguish, emotional distress, and medical care for that, which would be psychiatric service, psychological services, therapeutic support services, as well as chiropractic services. And so there's at least some substantial overlap with some of these categories. The family advocacy part of connecting folks, which I know a lot of personal injury lawyers will work hard to connect their clients to neuropsychological evaluations, physical and mental health assessments, stuff like that, as well as medical care that's appropriate. And then there's the Family Support Fund, which apparently is not seeking funds from the state, but if it's funded by the Minneapolis Foundation, medical bills would be included in compensation for injury claims.
Senator, I don't think that I think that including that as one of the offsets for any potential compensation may well be the best, appropriate provision. I'd have to
talk through it a little bit more through the details, but at least on the face of it, it seems like that's still that's what we're going to do. Representative Putnam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just go back for a minute to the discussion about the site-based parent support services. You know, I've listened to what Senator Betzel had to say in particular, and I share his concerns about some of the line items there. As I read it, though, I see that it's not necessarily that we're being asked to fund those things. We're not being asked to fund, for example, tobacco cessation services, and we're not being asked to fund computer literacy training, both of which I agree have a tenuous connection to what we're talking about here. But it looks like we're funding a position that will point people in the direction of those pre-existing services. Is that right? I guess I'm wondering then, thank you, Mr. Chair, a couple of related questions. I noticed that this is a line item that for which there is no other source funding. In other words, this is one that would be the state only. It's $60,000 in the first year, $40,000 in the second year, $20,000 in the third year. Two-part question. First, whoever wants to answer it, why isn't this also one of those leveraged line items? And secondly, could you explain the sort of the shrinking outlay over the 3 years?
Right.
The reason that there is no other source is that there is no other source that we know of. I mean, it's as simple as that. The Minneapolis Foundation, in our conversations with them, didn't find this to be within their scope. That's the direct answer to that question. Why it's a decreasing thing is that we think that that there will be less need if we do a good job with these parents, and so we would decrease the amount of resources necessary to do that. To me, this is an event that needs to be handled well, and it's not an event that that's going to occur way off into the future. So let's do it well, and particularly with the parent support stuff. I think from our perspective, it seemed to be logical to assume that they would have less need as the years progress. I should say less focused need. They will still have needs. I'm sure of that.
Senator
Shine. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I wasn't here for a little bit, but I don't think that it's been addressed in checking with Senator Hahn and Bethel. Could you explain how the Pillsbury United Communities is funded in the first place? I assume it's a nonprofit, but is it United Way funding? Is it the county involved at all, or the city or the school district? I'm just curious about that.
Mr. Weiner.
Yes, the Pillsbury United Communities is a nonprofit. We are proud of the fact that we were among the first nonprofits to be established in the state of Minnesota, 1895.
Oh,
we've been in continuous operation out of the Settlement House tradition. In fact, the name comes from the Pillsbury family. The wife of the founder of the Pillsbury Company was a board member, and her two sons donated $40,000 in 1905 to build a building in the Cedar Riverside area, and it was called Pillsbury House, and that's sort of as brief a history as I you probably want. The funding today is approximately 40% from government at all levels. The largest governmental unit is Tennessee County, but we receive money from the federal government, the state, and the city of Minneapolis as well. Another 20% comes from the United Way. Another 20% comes from corporate foundations and community foundations, and the rest is income that we either earn through fees and fees for service.
Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful.
Any further questions from the committee?
Sure.
Minor note, this one-page handout refers to bridge collapse on August 3rd. I think it's, if you correct it, it should be August 1st.
Thank you, Senator. You're absolutely correct.
Senator Wyatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of looking through some of the list here under therapeutic support. It seems like it's to try to connect people to services for the families that do not have adequate health insurance coverage. As I'm reading through the list here, those are also the kinds of things, except maybe networking within the community, that would be covered by a tort settlement. So at least payments for the services themselves would be covered by a tort settlement. And I'm just wondering how much overlap there may be between the proposal here and what would be compensated, at least for those who receive some physical injury on the bus, through the separate compensation process that this committee is considering.
Mr. Wagner?
That's been a lot. I think that's an ultimately reasonable approach, and we certainly would not want to be involved in anything but getting people to the right resource. And if it's being paid by somebody else, that's great. And so I think Representative Winkler suggested that is this if it gets finalized, that we certainly would be willing to work through that and try to figure out what the best approach to that that issue is.
Nothing further. I'd first like to just thank you for being able to be here. We got you notice, I think, at around 5 o'clock on Friday that we'd ask you to be here 8:30 Monday morning, and you've had your proposal drafted for some time, but thank you for being able to be here with such short notice and to have such good understanding of what that is. And we should also note that Julie, who was one of, what's Julie's last name?
Graves.
There we go. Is one of the, was one of the most seriously injured people in this bridge collapse, and is also really just a great fighting spirit for White House, and she's currently she's chaperoning a youth service project right now and back at it. So I think her time is better spent there than here. So thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kahn?
Questioning what the schedule is now.
I believe we have scheduled until 10:15.
Oh, okay. Some of us
talked to
have a conference. Mr. Chair. Representative
Silver. At 10:15, but then at later on today, do you know?
Well, Representative Solberg, I have a, I guess Christina can pass this out. I have sort of the first round of an offer from the House on where we could try to find a path forward. So in the next few minutes, we could review it. We could recess and come back in the afternoon and discuss that proposal if it's the will of the committee, or we can take the remaining time and do what we'd like. But we do have a proposal to pass out to see if we can.
And Mr. Chair, while it's being passed out, we do have finance at this time as well.
Maybe we'll see if there are any initial questions or comments, and we can then digest and come back. I think at 3 o'clock is when we have the time scheduled for reconvening. And members, I can claim any credit for typos or other grammatical types of mistakes in this particular proposal.
It would serve the process well for the Senate members to caucus on the question before we provide any formal response. Certainly appreciate the effort to help us move forward with this. I will note, just as a first blush here, just glancing at the document, that on the two key components here, the statutory codification of the catastrophe process and the question of caps on awards or no caps on awards, you're proposing the House position on the what I would view as perhaps less significant components. You're kind of splitting them up, House versus Senate position. But that's just my first blush here. I think we may have quite a ways to go, but I think the Senate conference probably, unless there's anyone else wishes to provide an initial response now, we should probably have some conversations among ourselves.
Okay. I don't hear any contrary voices, so we will recess to the call of the chair, which will be at 3 p.m., barring extraordinary events in either body.
If either body is still in a floor session, I think we should probably have it a certain time period after the last body.
We'll do, fair enough. We'll, if either is in session at 3 o'clock, we'll do 30 minutes following adjournment or recess, I guess, of the body that's last in session. Unless it's midnight. Senator, I'm going to reconvene the conference committee for House Files 2553. It is, well, now Senator Mula is gone AWOL.
She's coming back.
But I think this is as good as we're going to do. House members have Finance Committee and Tax Committee dealing with the budget bill and the health care reform bill in finance. And I know that Senator Scheid and Hand can't be here. I don't really know how much Representative Kahn is at a funeral. I don't really know how much substantive discussion we can accomplish. So I think my intention, anyway, is just to hear what, if there's questions about the proposal that we offered, I can just touch on the numbers very briefly, and then if there's any other discussion, otherwise we will just wrap things up for the day and come back tomorrow when Senator Lance has the gavel, which I think is scheduled for 3 o'clock. So that's my intention. Senator Bessel?
Well, I have a few questions, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I heard Representative Kahn the other day talking about, you know, her rationale for the making this permanent. I'd still like to hear a little bit more about the rationale, because, you know, if a year ago somebody had come to us and said, look, there's going to be a disaster, and people are going to die, and some people are going to get injured, and, you know, the state's probably going to be at fault, that's all I'm going to tell you. I wouldn't have known what to do. I would not have known how to put together some proposal, you know, put together anything. Is it possible that we may have another disaster down the road? I suppose so. Is it possible that it's going to be kind of like this one? Who knows? I think that, you know, if there is some other disaster at some point in the future, I think that a future legislature can certainly look back to what we did, and if they like what we did, that's fine. They can certainly tailor it to their needs. But I think it's kind of presumptuous to think that somehow we have all the answers, and that, you know, this whatever we said in, you know, here is going to be the answers from now on. Because I don't see that that's the way it really is. I think that I'd like to deal with the situation that we're dealing with, and if somebody else wants to borrow from us, then that's fine. But I just have some reservations about putting, you know, in the statute, this is the answer, and we don't have to go back and amend it, because around here, 90%, better than 90%, what we do is amend previous laws, and why would this be any different?
Senator Bessel, I, you know, far be it for me certainly to speak for Representative Kahn. I actually think Representative De La Forest may be able to do that better, not on this issue, but in general. However, one piece of information I've had on this aspect that I think is useful was the Director of Emergency Management for the City of St. Paul actually at one point touched base with me personally on this bill and liked the fact that we were doing this two-part structure, because from an emergency management point of view, they find it helpful to have something that they can point survivors or victims of some kind of major event, something that they can point them to say that the state is ready or some entity is ready for a handoff. You are not leaving the Red Cross and entering a void where there's nobody there to support you. And so from an emergency management point of view, there is, I think, a justification for this kind of two-tier structure. Again, the bill's kind of developed in separate paths, House and Senate. And we've discussed this at some length. The House bill comes a bit more from the perspective of dealing with some sort of major disaster of historic proportions, I believe was the governor's term, that kind of perspective. The Senate bill comes more from a tort perspective, and that's why I think we were structuring it that way. I think there's an argument to be made, however, that we should see how this one works before we set it in stone. I've heard both arguments.
Well, and Mr. Chair, even if we were to put something permanent in statute, even under the House proposal, you'd still have to come back and make an appropriation. So I don't know what kind of assurances anybody can give to victims except that, well, the legislature has to put money into it. And unless that happens, it's just some words on paper. So I don't know what kind of signal we're sending out just to have some words on paper. Unless, you know, if we created a permanent fund, I guess there would be some assurances there, but we're not even proposing that. So, Mr. Chair, I do have a couple of other questions here. I guess I want to learn a little bit more about the House's position and how you arrived at your overall number. I want to clear up at least what I think might be a misperception of what is expected of this conference committee. I've received my share of emails saying that people prefer, victims and their families prefer the House language because they want no caps. Well, of course, in a strict sense, the Senate bill does limit the liability to, you know, the caps are at $400,000. But I think there may be some people who believe that somehow there are no caps with the House bill. And as I understood the information the other day, is that the House is looking at appropriation for this time, and this is probably it. This is all the appropriation we're looking at. Now, you know, can we come back next year and put a little bit more in? You know, I suppose that's possible, but this is mainly it. So it isn't like we're creating some unlimited trust fund that is going to be taking care of, you know, every conceivable financial problem that are legitimate that some of these victims have. I mean, at the end of the day, when all is said and done, no matter which number we go with, the House and Senate bill, there's going to be, I think, checks issued. It's not going to cover, in some instances, all of the, you know, the damage that has been done, but that's the limit. And I think if people somehow expect that this is going, that, you know, there is no limit, I think that they're mistaken. And even under the House bill, whether you call it caps or not caps, there's a limit. And so I'm interested in knowing, first of all, how the House came up with, you know, the number that you have of around $40 million, and what is that going to buy? And in fact, you know, is it the House's understanding as well too that there's a limit to the number of dollars, and then after when we hit that limit, it's over.
Senator Betzel, Ms. Roberts can add some more of the fiscal analysis side. This is imperfect. There was a lot of I think caveats that preceded Mr. Mossman and Ms. Roberts' presentation of the numbers at our earlier hearing, and for good reason. We have to make a number of assumptions to get to anything close to the range that we're talking about. In general, the range of discussion has been somewhere between $30 million and I think $75 million, or 30 to 60, depending on. And Ms. Roberts can talk about that. The $40 million number was arrived at in consultation with the Ways and Means Chair, the Fiscal Chair on the House side, with the Commissioner of Finance. The $40 million number, therefore, is now in the House supplemental budget, and it was in the Governor's supplemental budget. So, in part, it's a recognition of limited budget realities, The $40 million certainly is intended to be the final appropriation amount, and I think the House modified proposal here reflects the fact that we'd like to make that clear statement to the special master panel that this is the total amount that they have to deal with. They shouldn't assume there will be anything more, and that they have we've changed the timing here as well so that they'll have a date fixed by which they know the amount of money in case gifts come in. They know what the claims are, and they'll have to divide it as fairly as they can. So the $40 million kind of is on the lower half, anyway, of that range. And Ms. Roberts, I think, can give you a little bit more information.
Well, just Mr. Chair, on that particular point, and I don't know how $30 to $75 million was arrived at. I would certainly hope that whatever number we come up with is a number that we can somehow justify. I would hope that we would not say, well, because we have a budget deficit, we can't do as much this time around. Any more than if we had a budget surplus, we'd be able to say, well, we have some money, so let's spend more money on this expense. Because, again, we don't know what the next situation will be like if there is a next situation. I don't want to spend, whether it's this issue or any others, I don't want the state to spend more than it must or has to, but I don't want to spend any less than what we should. And I'd like to be able to at least justify whatever number we come up with as saying this is a logical reason, there's reasons why we came up with this number, not because we were looking at a range and $40 million looked like what we could do this year. So, you know, I'd like to be able to at least pin down a number and perhaps, you know, fiscal staff can indicate that to us.
Ms. Roberts, I think you can help clarify. Oh, Senator Lass?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up in terms of the context. You know, from the beginning when I was involved in this issue, we were looking at a range of $6 million to $60 million is what we had originally looked at as possibilities before we had a lot of information came in. I think there was some thought that it was going to be quite a bit more than $6 million at some point. You know, we had a fairly detailed analysis. We arrived at our number after we got information on what we thought would be damages amounts, rather than working backwards. We gathered the information first to see, and we applied the principles in the bill to what the information we learned about potential damage calculations to come up with the particular number in the Senate bill. I remember Representative Winkler in the first hearing here when this question came up, you said that the $40 million was kind of a budgetary comfort level with how you characterized the House's settling on that dollar amount. And that amount, of course, occurred before the governor's office announced their budget proposals. This number was in the House bill before the governor came out with his budget proposals. So when I asked the governor's office, why they chose $40 million, half from the trunk highway fund, half from the general fund, total of $40 million, their response was that it was a placeholder, recognizing the House had put $40 million in, and they wanted to at least make sure they had enough calculated in their budget to factor what they thought was going to be the highest number that would come out of a legislative response. So not that there was any more solid basis for it than a budgetary placeholder, understanding we had to work through our process to come up with a number that would be a final result. So that's the information that I have.
Well, and Senator Lass, that Representative Silver was, I think, clear here that, and he's not here to speak for himself, unfortunately, but the number, that $40 million number, was not first proposed by the House, but it was arrived at in consultation between the House Finance Chair, Ways and Means Chair, and Commissioner Hansen of the Department of Finance. That's where the number came from. It's $40 million. It's a round number. Obviously, that's not tailored to the specific dollar amount, but the reality is that it's hard to pinpoint the precise dollar amount based on the information that we have, and we have to make a number of assumptions to get there. And I think it would be useful if Helen were to just briefly kind of walk through what those assumptions are.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm trying to revisit some discussions and calculations that were made several months ago, and I think the house number was based about at the time when the final notice, the notices of claims came in, so we did have some of that information. And I'm just looking at I pulled this up from my notes, because there were several ongoing conversations, and in fact, at times we may have actually been sitting down and trying some different assumptions, but the range that Representative Winkler referred to, I have a calculation based after a discussion with the Department of Administration claims staff, and some of their, using their experience to sort of ballpark what they thought the final settlements would be on these different kinds of cases. And I don't want to present these numbers as their numbers, but I was sort of working off some of their assumptions. And the range was from about $35 million to $70 million. That's a low, medium, and high calculation. And what I should point out is where the variation takes place is in the assumption that you use for the final payments that would be made for the survivors of people that were killed on the bridge. That's the assumption that is made there is what's going to drive the biggest variation in numbers, and we were using a range of about $1 million to $3 million. And while that may seem like that's a big range for an average calculation for a payment, I think actually, and I did discuss this with Mr. Mossman, if you go back and look at his model, what can really impact that is the assumption that's made on the collateral offset payments for the fatalities. And if you use the assumptions that were done in the Senate fiscal, and using the sort of middle of the range, you would come up with an assumption of about, or a calculation of about $44 million under the House model using the Senate assumption for the total payments. If you revisit that collateral offset assumption, and I want to say I'm not an expert in any of this. I don't have experience in calculating what an appropriate collateral offset would be, but for death, in the cases of death, there could be an argument made that the collateral offsets would be much smaller than in the other cases because we're not talking about medical insurance payments. And so that's where if you make an adjustment just on that alone, you can get bumped up to the higher range of about $60, $65 million. And again, I did sort of do this using, trying to revisit the calculations that were made several months ago, but then have sort of run it through Mr. Mossman's model, and I think you'll see that once you remove the cap and then try different assumptions just on the collateral offset, that's how you come up with the range. And again, it might be something that the conference committee needs to explore some more, what would be the correct kind of assumptions for that.
So, Mr. Chair, in other words, if 400,000 under the current law is not the correct number, but then in essence, we'd almost have to be spotting the number. Is that correct? I mean, if we don't think 400,000 is enough, but we think 500,000 or 800,000 or a million is, ultimately, I mean, if Mr. Mossman has had the correct number, I mean, we know about the 13 individuals who died. We know about the, 18 or so that were seriously injured, and then there were some after that. I mean, that's for the bulk of the money, I think, is what we're going to be looking at. So, in essence, we'd be asked to, if we're going to waive the caps, just pick new caps. Is that what we have to do using the same model? It's just how far do we want to raise the bar? Is that what we're doing?
Senator Betzel, I don't think that's the exercise. For one thing, we haven't gone through the kind of detailed fact-finding that a special master panel under this proposal would have to do to determine exactly what the collateral offsets will be. And that's the point, I guess, of moving this out of the legislative sphere and into a judicial or quasi-judicial, I guess, kind of sphere to determine what the facts are. So we can make we can use assumptions to say that we assume that the cap becomes this amount under this appropriation amount, but we're not setting any kind of number in stone. We're just making the kind of legislative decision that we make on fiscal matters here all the time, which is that we do the best we can to get the number that we think is most accurate.
But, I mean, I don't know what kind of fact-finding beyond the collateral offsets we're talking about. I mean, for the 13 who died, are we going to look at unique situations to find out if one family is more deserving of more money than another family? Or, I mean, and maybe this is the job of the special master, but I think we should have some hint as to whether we think they all should be treated the same or whether they should be treated differently. As for the ones who are more seriously injured, I think we're talking about medical expenses and wage losses, you know, that were not covered by some other source. But at some point, as I say, you know, we have a finite amount here. We're not setting up some limitless trust fund. So I think we have to make some basic assumptions as to ultimately what we think the victims and their families will wind up receiving, because that's the number that we're going to have to justify at the end. And for that standpoint, I don't know that 40,000, you know, is or is not the right number. It just, you know, I'm sure it'll spend. I just don't know that at the end of the day, somebody's just going to have to apportion it out, whatever number we come up with. Mr. Chair, those are some concerns of mine. I do have a couple others that I've spotted on the House proposal, and these are not as complicated. On the special master, you wanted the panel to be appointed by the entire Supreme Court instead of by the Chief Justice. I'm interested in your thoughts on that, and let me... Senator Latz, when he brought in the appointment of the Chief Justice, the question I had raised on that was that it's possible there may be some litigation coming out of this, and ultimately the litigation could go up to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Would the Chief Justice wind up with any kind of a conflict of interest or having some issues that would cause the Chief Justice to be recused? Now, that was before, of course, the current Chief Justice announced his retirement. So I think it's possible that, you know, whatever appointments are made may be done by the current Chief Justice as opposed to the next Chief Justice. But if the entire, I think it's rather unusual to have the entire Supreme Court involved with the selection process. I think there's plenty of precedent for the Chief Justice to do it. But if there are these issues of concern that I've raised, would we not have a situation where the entire Supreme Court might have to be recused as opposed to just one justice, the Chief Justice?
Senator Bethold, first on the, actually, the reason, one of the reasons I thought it might be better for the Supreme Court as a whole to make the decision is the fact that we'll want them to make a decision quickly, but I'm fearful of having a Chief Justice that we know is going to retire and therefore no longer be in public service, making a crucial appointment and not being around to be responsible for the outcome. And so I thought by making the court itself the appointing authority, we might avoid that issue. But I know that Senator Representative Simon has a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bethel. That's a great question or an interesting inquiry. And I looked into this in connection with another bill that I was carrying this session having to do with judicial reform, as you're aware. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered was that in the statutes it's mixed. Sometimes it refers to the Chief Justice, sometimes to the Supreme Court. The advantage of the Supreme Court, and I checked this, is that when it says Supreme Court and not Chief Justice, they will more often than not conference the issue, which means whether this is a good thing or bad, that the whole Supreme Court really does decide. I asked the question at the time in connection with this other bill, if something says Supreme Court shall choose, does this mean as a practical matter that the associate justices say, hey, Chief, we're busy, why don't you just pick and we'll back you 100%? And the answer I got was no, that the associate justices in that case do want to at least have a perfunctory discussion of some kind, and it means that the whole court really is involved. Now, for reasons that you talk about, recusal, I don't know the answer there. If that's a concern, then that's something we'll have to rethink. But I generally think saying Supreme Court rather than Chief Justice is the better way to go, all other things being equal, for that reason.
And frankly, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Simon, I mean, whether the Chief Justice is retiring or not is immaterial to me. I mean, the Chief Justice is the Chief Justice, and I don't think that the fact that this person is leaving is going to make the Chief Justice is going to take any less of an interest or do a worse job just because he happens to be retiring. And in fact, there may be some loose ends that the next Chief Justice may have to tie together. I'd like to limit, you know, the issues that could wind up to the Supreme Court to one person if I could. And that is why I question, you know, expanding to the whole court rather than just the Chief Justice. But it's something maybe we want to ponder. I don't have, you know, it's just something I want to call to your attention.
Thank you, Senator. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that one of the reasons why we had the executive council on the original bill was the concern about a potential conflict. I guess, frankly, I like the idea of the administrative side of things being mm-hmm. to the judicial branch, particularly data practices and other things. So we may have to revisit that overall issue. But there are certain advantages that come with the judicial branch being the administrators of this.
Another question I've got, Mr. Chair, on your damages definition, you want the special master to consider mental suffering that does not rise to the level of negligent infliction of emotional distress standard. Which, of course, as I understand it, that means that, you know, you have to have some sort of an injury in order to have emotional distress. It's been my assumption that, first of all, the only people who are going to qualify for any damages, I think that we set forth, had to actually have been on the bridge. There are many people traumatized by that. In fact, at my law office, there's a woman who looks across the hall that apparently was right at somebody cut in front of her as the bridge went down. She did not, she stopped right there at the edge. And she's traumatized by it. But I think that at some point we have to make the decision that you had to have been on the bridge. Does this expand the pool of those who might claim that they have suffered from distress, even though they may have witnessed it or been close to it or been traumatized by it? How far are we going to go?
Senator Bessel, the House, under survivor definition, we have a House position which does specify that you had to be on the bridge. I did add a provision, and this is for discussion, frankly, related to the concern that I think Representative Kahn raised, that there were a few people, anyway, who were emergency volunteers and ended up with physical injuries. And so the definition of survivor I included in here to expand them that way, but otherwise you have to be on the bridge to qualify. And so you would not be, I guess, the person that you referenced, that you know, would not qualify under this definition.
Well, Mr. Chair, we heard some testimony from White House this morning, and it's my understanding that, you know, some of those students, you know, were not physically injured. They probably were traumatized, and they may very well have issues and problems. And I don't know to what extent we try to address the emotional distress that some of them suffered, and some were young children. But I want to make sure that whatever we do actually addresses the problem and actually gets the money to the victims, which, you know, I mean, ties not only to the White House, but also the other victims that you know, we've heard about. So, and unfortunately, I think this might be opening the door, you know, to some other issues that, you know, are not as clearly as defined as I think we need to have them.
That's what I have, Mr. Chair.
Other comments? Or
Senator Lassiter, Chair, a little bit of follow-up on that. I don't know if we know exactly how many people were on the bridge that did not suffer any physical injury. The tort of negligent infliction of emotional distress is a very narrowly defined tort, so it's very limited circumstances, probably none of which would apply on the bridge to allow someone who was not physically injured to recover mental anguish damages. So the rule in Minnesota has for many years been that under tort law, if you seek recovery for mental anguish, it can only be in connection with having received physical injuries first, and then mental anguish damages could flow from the event. But if you suffered no physical injuries, then you're not entitled to recover any mental anguish or pain and suffering damages. So even for those who were on the bridge, proposal such as yours would open the door to a whole new level compensation rule in Minnesota. And I wonder if that was your intent, and how would you propose to put limits on that if you would open the door here?
Senator, the intent is not to change the tort rule in the state of Minnesota, and in the House version of the damages definition, we don't actually refer explicitly to the tort rules. I thought that that referring to the tort damages definitions is helpful as the Senate approaches it, because it would give, I think, more clear guidance to the special master panel as to how to proceed. However, I've heard significant emphasis, I guess, from Diane Loeffler, Representative Loeffler on the Claims Committee, and other members of the House about the importance of treating these kind of pure emotional damage, mental health kind of claims with some kind of parity with physical injury. And if we could craft a bill to accommodate that and not change the status of tort law in Minnesota, I think all the better. The House bill didn't do that because we didn't try to refer directly to the tort law as a guide.
Mr. Chair, I know in previous conversations before the legislative process formally began on this, you were of the, at least had expressed the position that the House bill that was forthcoming would include only the tort range of damages that would be compensable. And so I was a bit surprised when we were going through the side-by-side to see that there was no such limit in the House bill that ultimately emerged, that there was this lengthy, much broader list of compensable losses that were in the general catastrophe compensation definitions without any guidelines referring to the existing tort law. So for me, there was kind of a disconnect there that surprised me. I think we get back to another question of precedent, that no matter how much we try to claim that we're limiting or proposing to limit whatever we do here just to a bridge collapse, how do you justify not applying a new rule to the next person who comes down the road who suffered a severe emotional trauma from seeing a state vehicle get into an accident right in front of them during a snowstorm or whatever, kill someone, and they happen to drive by the accident as it's happening, and they suffered a horrible emotional trauma. They can't sleep at night. They get diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and they bring a claim against the state saying it's the state's fault. And how do you tell them they're not entitled to compensation when they're, you know, almost as much a part of the incident? Maybe they were narrowly missed, in the accident. Maybe they were a part of the process of the accident but didn't happen to suffer any physical injury. I mean, how do you draw those distinctions from an equity or fairness standpoint once you open that door?
Senator, there is, it's not easy, I guess, and I, Representative Simon talked about the slippery slope being and drawing lines of legislature being something that we do all the time. But I'm responding primarily to a position that I've heard members of the Claims Committee and others take on this particular issue. And again, we're not terribly far off from the tort definition. My understanding of negligent infliction of emotional distress means that you have to have some physical manifestation accompanying a mental distress, or not accompanying, but demonstrating mental distress. And if we can use that definition and we think we can cover most of the cases, that may be an option to pursue as well. So that we wouldn't have this exception, but I think it's a fair point of discussion at least.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it would help to get a more clear definition of negligent infliction of emotional distress and determine more specifically how many, if any, potential claimants arising out of this incident would qualify for that, so we can at least get our arms around that question a little bit more directly. I also had a question to follow up on Senator Betzold about, or his comment relating to the establishment of a broader catastrophe fund. And I think one of the arguments you have made in support of a broader statute is that we'd already have something in place, we'd know how to deal with it. I've got two concerns with that. One is It certainly would create an expectation then that the legislature would in fact come into session, come up with money, and deal with whatever the incident is that arises that would result in that call or claim. Any snowstorm, any tornado, any flood, anything that and because it's so written so broadly, it's natural disasters, acts of God, and or if this is caused by human action or inaction. It's just a whole broad standard, and I can imagine every legislator that has an incident in their district is going to feel compelled to look out for their constituents by introducing a bill that says we need to compensate so-and-so for this loss because it arose out of this incident. And then how do we draw the line? And how do we say this is big enough or significant enough to justify special action? This isn't. Are we creating unrealistic expectations? Are we creating expectations as politicians trying to do the good thing are going to feel compelled to fulfill those expectations by the very fact that the vehicle exists in order to do it? And then my second question has to do with the proposal that it would streamline or make easier the process of responding. But the way in which it's written, with the broad definitions of losses, including losses of business opportunity, a whole variety of economic losses or non-economic losses that may or may not be covered in existing tort law, because it would include personal injury losses or death losses in addition to infrastructure losses or cost of rebuilding, which is the more traditional response of state government from natural disasters. Seems to me that's going to open up a huge area of discussion or debate anytime there's a natural disaster. And I'll give you an example. The Southeast Minnesota floods, I'm told, had 5 deaths relating to it. As far as I'm aware, there isn't any example in at least recent Minnesota history where there has been a natural disaster and the state stepped in and compensated families for the death of a family member or compensated an injured person for an injury. But if we end up on the House or the Senate floor trying to figure out how much is that person's injury loss, how much is that person's death loss, do they get more because they died this way instead of because of a different kind of a natural disaster? If a tornado knocked a tree down on their car, Is that more or less traumatic than if they drowned because of a flood? How do we calculate things? How does that compare to other death valuations? It seems to me we end up with a much longer, more contentious, more drawn-out process that's less likely to result in consensus ahead of time in a special session, if that were to be the case, than if we simply concentrate on what we already know how to do, which we've done for many, many years, which is if there's a natural disaster, we've got a public responsibility for public infrastructure. We step in to rebuild the roads, to rebuild the bridge, to rebuild the community center, or whatever the case may be. But we don't get into the question of personal injuries or deaths. And that's a whole new area that this bill would take us into without any guidelines even for addressing.
Well, Senator, when we have a disaster response, we do more than just rebuild public infrastructure. I think Representative Solberg has probably seen a number of these over time. But we also get into the issue of loans for businesses. I mean, this may not always be through the state of Minnesota, but certainly through FEMA and in part through the state, loans for businesses, loans to help homeowners recover. Even if a loan is not a direct check, if you subsidize it and make it low interest or forgivable or something like that, you are providing a direct financial aid or benefit to the individuals who are affected by it. So I don't think that this is so fundamentally different in the sense that we're trying to help address some of the individual needs. I think the bigger issue is really how do... It's not that easy to get things moved through the legislative process as it is. We make these kind of discretionary calls all the time for natural disasters, and we're not changing that. We're leaving that discretion in place for future legislators and the governor to be able to decide if a particular event rises to that type of level that would be justified under this statutory scheme. So we're talking about a unique kind of future event that would even, I think, be dealt with in this scenario. And I don't think we're making it more complicated. I think we're giving them a guide as to what our experience has been as a result of this one. And members, we can entertain a little bit more discussion here, but I know that this is an issue of particular importance to Representative Kahn, and I don't think we can have a full discussion about the two-tier structure of the House bill without her presence. And unfortunately, she's at, I think I mentioned, at a funeral and unable to join us, so I think we can't really go much further. And I have a conflict myself that I have to attend to, which is a medical appointment at home. So I am hoping that we can wrap this up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just make one point, and I'll certainly be done. I think you made the comment that we change policy all the time. That's true. I mean, the legislature is here to represent the public will when we can figure out what the public will is. Those of us who live through tripartisan government remember how difficult it was trying to figure things out when we had a DFL Senate, Republican House, and 30-party governor, but that was the public will, and we did our best. When you're dealing with funding issues, precedent really matters a lot, and it isn't easy to say, well, you know, we got a different legislature, a different governor, let's change things, because as we know, you know, when we try to set our state's budget, most of the decisions have already been made because the base has been set. Can you go and make changes? Of course you can. It's just very difficult to do it. I serve on the Pensions Commission. Precedent, when you're dealing with money for individuals, means and matters a lot. And we try to be very deliberative and careful because we know no matter what we do, somebody's going to come back at a later time and say, well, you did it there, you got to do it here. And frankly, you know, the legislature isn't always very good at saying, well, okay, I know we did it there, but we're not going to do it this time. I am really afraid that, you know, if we make a significant deviation here, it is something that either we or some future legislature is going to wish we hadn't done. So I think we need to be very careful about this.
For the time, and I know that we're cutting the discussion a little bit short, but we don't have all members here, and I think that it's hard to really explain where we're coming from and try to find a path forward without, I think, that kind of informed discussion. So I think we should wrap it up until tomorrow.
Senator
Moore. Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll just put my question on the table, and then maybe we'll come back and pick it up. But I would be interested in hearing a further discussion from the House members and maybe House Research on what is contemplated to sort of be the parameters on the expenditure scheme in the House proposal. Whether it's sort of, you know, we put the amount out there and the special master will make that determination based on a certain set of factors, or is it our intention to be a little bit more prescriptive about what the parameters are and what's, you know, being contemplated? Is there sort of an upper limit? Because, you know, one or two cases can't hopefully consume up the entire amount, because at some point we hope that we would be able to meet everyone else's needs. So I'll just put that question on the table, and we can come back and pick it up.
I mean, I'll be happy. I'm sure a lot of us will be happy to recap our comments for Representative Kahn when she's able to join us, or provide her with a transcript of the proceedings. But I'll just close my comments on that piece by saying that we know how to respond very quickly to natural disasters. We did it in September in the special session. I don't think we need a new statutory template to show us how to do that. What's unique about the proposed statutory template is that it goes beyond natural disasters to personal injury claims. I think that raises a whole lot of complications. Let's just leave it at that for now.
Senator, I won't respond to the second part, but there actually is a bill going through both House and Senate to codify and revise significantly the way that the state responds to natural disasters, because the representatives, senators, and I think the administration felt that our response to the southeastern Minnesota floods was not as efficient and well-organized as it possibly could be. So there actually is a big bill going through to try to codify roles and responsibilities and clearly outline how those kind of responses work. So,
with regard to scheduling, before you gavel us shut, you know, we've obviously taken some time to consider the House's proposal. We obviously have some questions about it. They're trying to flesh out a little more information before we formulate a response. My understanding, we have not completed that process, obviously. It's unfortunate. I understand why Representative Kahn can't be here, but we weren't able to complete that here today. It's our intent to, in fact, get together, hopefully tomorrow, to try to put together a more specific response. The House is going into session at 10, and so are we. I know we have planned a lengthy floor session. We've been told planning to go into mid to late afternoon on the floor. So it's going to be kind of hard to predict what availability may be for us to coalesce as a Senate conference group to agree on a response. I think what we may need to do at this point is, rather than say for sure that we're going to come back together at the conference committee tomorrow, is to say we'll leave it a little bit open and see what the House's timeline looks like on the floor and what ours looks like on the floor. I wouldn't want to reconvene simply for the purpose of 1 hour to hand you a piece of paper and then adjourn and then not really have accomplished much. We could hand you a piece of paper without convening and maybe keep the process moving forward in that regard if we can come to an agreement, not having had a full chance to flesh out some of the questions we have today. But I would suggest we leave it open a little bit right now as to whether we will reconvene the conference committee tomorrow or possibly instead the next day. So I guess stay tuned is the short way to say it.
Right. If there's nothing further, we will adjourn.